Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, the brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg and currently worn by world number 28, Jan-Lennard Struff, world number 61, Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at HollibertSports.com for 15% off of all performance Diadora tennis shoes. ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. With Scope Fan Clubs, you can access premium behind-the-scenes content and chat with their players that include world number 62 Flavio Cobolli, who just played Rafa, and world number 25 Talon Griekspoor. See them at scopesports.io to see what they are all about. We have a very special show for you today. He grew up in Brisbane, Australia, and got to 33 in the world in 2018 after defeating Roger Federer in the fourth round of the U.S. Open. Over the course of his 16-plus year career, he has posted wins over Dimitrov, Ferrer, and Dominic Thiem, to name a few. He retired at this past Australian Open, and we talked about it all. John Millman is today's guest. Now, hang on a second. Are you in Brisbane?
Yes, I am.
And that's born and raised?
Born and bred. Yep, never left.
That's the Gold Coast.
Nah, well, Gold Coast is in Queensland. So Brisbane's the capital of Queensland. Gold Coast is a city of Queensland, but it's only about 45 minutes south of here.
Gentlemen, you hear former world number 33. He hung it up at 34. Got to 33, finished when he was 34 just this past January, held the torch, did a lot for Australian tennis for a lot of years, a very well-liked guy in and around tennis. John Millman, nice to see you, my man.
No, thanks for having me. It's good to talk tennis.
Yeah, you've been out of the mix a little bit from what I gather.
I have. I'm back home, which is a really nice thing. It's a blessing for an Australian to be able to spend long periods of time back home, because for the 16 to 18 years that I was traveling, we'd spend probably about 11 months away overseas. So to be back home, it's a change of pace, but it's a good change of pace.
As you know, we do a five-set format. The first set is indeed the off-the-court report. So is it true that you're going to college? Are you a matriculating college student?
Yeah, like our college system's a little bit different to the ones that I'm aware of in the States. But yeah, so postgraduate studies here. I'm at a university called Queensland University of Technology, just down the road from where I live. And I'm doing a master's in business administration. So that's been taking up a little bit of my time. It started in January when the Australian Open was on, so I had a little bit of catching up to do. But it's been good. It's been a real big change of pace, but I'm doing it with a bunch of really good people. And it's nice to do something that's so different, you know, to get out of your comfort zone and to challenge yourself in a different way to what tennis challenged you.
And MBA is not easy, man. That's hard work. Do you actually go to class, or are you doing it digitally?
No, we go to class. We do some extensive classes. So this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'm back in class. I've got an oral presentation on Sunday, so I've been practicing that. You know, I come from a family of educators too. My mum and dad were school teachers, and it was always really important that I didn't go and dive into that junior tour back in the day. I was told that I had to finish my school and whatnot. So it's always been important to me to better educate yourself and to get out of that bubble. Because as we know, I love the tennis bubble, but it is a bit of a bubble.
Are you struggling? Tell me the truth. Like, how are you doing in your classes?
No, I'm got my head above water right now. It was a bit of a shock to the system, but so far the early grades that have come in have been pretty positive. So I'm not going to say I love every minute of it, but I think that's part and parcel. I didn't love every minute of the tennis either.
Now, hang on. Now, you were one of the most fit guys. You were a very fit guy. Have you lost your fitness?
Yeah.
Have you completely tanked ever since you quit tennis?
I haven't stepped foot in a gym or done any body management rehab programs. Now, what I have spent my time doing is playing a bit of golf. I love my golf, even though I'm not that good at it, but I really enjoy it. We've got club championships at my club coming up in a in a month or two. So I've got that. And also I've joined the over 35s Division 6 Southside Eagles soccer team. So I play that on a Friday night. It gets actually pretty competitive. Some of these guys, they put their boot through you a little bit, but I'm really enjoying it. I love coming back and playing a team sport. When I was on the tour, one of my favorite things actually playing Davis Cup. So to be back in that environment, going from an individual sport to a team one, regardless of the standard or the level, I'm really enjoying those things. So that's how I'm getting my little bit of fitness. But yeah, I haven't been in the gym yet and I haven't got too much motivation to get there just yet.
Well, so many years of grinding, it's got to just be the best feeling ever to not go.
I think also just not feeling guilty with what you eat. You know, I had to be pretty professional when I played the tennis because, you know, things didn't come so easy. I wasn't some born gifted superstar. So I had to tick every little box. That's why I put a massive emphasis on trying to put myself in a really good physical shape and in good physical order. And that included what I was doing off the court. And I've got a bit of a sweet tooth, I tell you. So I've enjoyed, since retirement, tucking into a bit of ice cream with chocolate topping. I don't miss the dieting or any of that that you had on the tour.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report. This is where we talk about the business of tennis and all those kind of things. You stop right as the politics and the politics like really have heated up. Do you keep your eye on that? Do you have any involvement with what is sort of happening with the PIF and Tennis Australia and the majors trying to put together this super tour, and they are pitted versus Andrea Gaudenzi? I understand that you were very pro ATP at the back end of your career when there was a lot to, between the PTPA and the ATP. Where are you at with everything? What can you tell us?
Yeah, no, I do keep my eye on it, and I tell you what. It's funny to think that this is a tumultuous time because it is. It's you know, there's a lot of tensions and there's a lot of agendas there. But I was lucky enough to sit on the player council. I sat on that for 3 years, and I thought that was during a time where tensions were high. You know, that was when COVID had come in. So on the player council, you're trying to work out times to get back and when we could play tennis more effectively. We had Wimbledon banning players. We had Grand Slams changing tournament dates without a whole lot of consultation either. So there was actually a lot of things going on when I was sitting on the player council. And now you've got the Saudi fund coming in and really kind of changing up the game there. In terms of myself, look, I wouldn't say necessarily I'm pro ATP, but I am pro tennis. And I think that everyone has to live under the same roof, right? And so whilst I was on the ATP Player Council, I wanted to entertain what the PTPA were doing because you're representing players as a whole. And there were a lot of passionate people who they weren't being represented. And that's that in essence, that's why the PTPA existed. So I think, and I think my peers would probably say the same thing. I was very open. I went to a fair few of the PTPA meetings just to see as a sport what we could be doing better and what mattered the most for the players. So right now, well, we saw the massive shakeup in golf and what happened there and the money that the PIF fund kind of brought into the game. And the Grand Slams won't want that to happen. The Grand Slams, you know, the Grand Slams are the ones that probably have the most to lose in this situation. They are the tournaments that bring in the money, and they want their places on the calendar secured. I think that's the main thing. So if you had your Tennis Australia hat on, they want that first week of January secured, that month of January. You know, any external threat, they're obviously going to try to look after their best interests too. No, I was about to say, I was often asked, at the Australian Open in particular, I was asked, you know, how I feel about the money, from where that money comes from, potentially. And that's where I'm a little bit divided. I understand that question, but I also know that we've hosted plenty of other events there in the past before this became an issue, and we didn't seem to take the moral high ground there. So yeah, I think it's quite a delicate situation right now, and It's one that's actually a space that we've got to really keep our finger on the pulse.
So is that the compromise that the French Federation is essentially willing to like kill or move Bercy, give it to the Saudis, and then Ty Lee and the Tennis Australia keeps their January summer down under intact? Is that what we're reading right now?
Look, I would see that to be the logical step if this were to go ahead. I think the Grand Slams want to have their weeks. It's important for the success of the tournament for the Grand Slams to have their weeks. So if this train's on its tracks and it's heading full steam ahead, then that would be a priority for the Grand Slams.
For our listeners, was reported a day or two ago, Matt Futterman reported that, you know, there's going to be big meetings in London next week in advance of Madrid, which I was a little surprised about. I thought everyone was going to be converging on Madrid. That still may be true. The reporting was that the French Federation is willing to get the Saudi deal done. They would essentially, I guess, give up their license to Bercy, you know, the Paris Indoors, famous tournament. There's going to be some people upset about that for sure.
Incredible crowds at that tournament too. Yeah. The French people at the end of the year and those indoor tournaments really get behind that tournament, Bercy. It was obviously one of those tournaments too that didn't really have the capability to go to that almost 2-week format that we've seen starting to come in at ATP and WTA levels, just because the facility wasn't quite big enough. But in terms of a spectator, man, that Parisian crowd was wild. And if you're playing against someone they liked and they didn't like you, you really felt it.
Paris Indoors is a cool tournament. You just brought up a topic. I'd like to get brief thoughts about the prevalence of these long tournaments. Every tournament feels like it's taking a month. How are we feeling about that?
Yeah, look, this came about actually when I was on the player council. Gaudenzi's vision to have a premium tour, so to speak. So you could package it all up in one and sell this to your Amazons or one of these big providers. So to get all the aggregation rights together as one big premium product and then go to market. And part of that was obviously having something like 30 weeks of tennis, and how they could guarantee 30 weeks of tennis was to have these extended tournaments. So it makes sense from a business point of view. I from a spectator now that I'm on the outside and looking in, I feel as if they drag on a little bit. When you get to these Masters tournaments, I want to see my Jannik Sinners playing day in, day out. You know, I want to see my Carlos Alcarazes and your Novak Djokovic's playing, you know, on consecutive days. And it just feels as if they do drag on quite a while. So I hope the players are getting compensated, you know, for this. I know it is a little bit disruptive in the tour itself for those people that aren't quite making these Masters events. It's a long time to not have a high level tournament. It's a long time between drinks. I'd like to hear your take on it as a spectator now. Do you like the long events, or
those tournaments feel really long?
Yeah, I agree.
And it feels like the schedules seem sparse at the top and the sparse at the back, and but I also feel like, you know, you got to shake things up sometimes, and there's always growing pains involved, right?
Yeah, and one thing I will add to that, and having a longer amount of tournaments, and maybe this is the kid in me, but I love the idea of taking tennis to the masses and taking tennis to the regions and taking tennis all over the world. In terms of that, it eats up a lot of schedule. And that's what I loved about the old format of Davis Cup, right? All of a sudden, Davis Cup is popping up in the middle of South America somewhere where they might not have access to, and people might not have access to that level of tennis. And that's why I love the old format, the home and away. In essence, by having these long, protracted, drawn-out tournaments, it just leaves less space in the calendar to take tennis globally.
Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. Your story is a quintessentially Australian story. I'm curious how you got started and how you got good.
Yeah, look, I grew up in suburbia Brisbane. There was a tennis court in the backyard. My old man played in the old National Soccer League, and part of his contract was to get a court built in his backyard. Not because he had any interest in tennis, but his daughters, I've got four sisters, three are older, but they just played it casually a little bit locally. So he thought he'd build them a court. And from a young age, I was drawn to it. I was drawn to mostly beating my sisters. I really got a lot of pleasure in beating them. But the one thing I did have the ability to at a young age is, and I, for as long as I can remember, dragging down the ball machine when I was 5, 6 years old, was my ability to be able to be on court by myself and put in time by yourself, which became really important later on, because when you're traveling overseas yourself with a coach, which you have to do as an Australian player, because it's just too expensive and there's not enough tournaments here in Australia, you have to be willing to be good in your own skin and be able to put in the work when no one else is watching. So I learned a lesson young, and that was probably one of my greatest strengths. But then I let life kind of take its course. I didn't really do many juniors. I was always competitive. In national events, I won a national title or two. But school was really a big thing for our family, because mum and dad were teachers and they didn't really understand the tennis world.
Okay, so your father played pro soccer and he negotiated a tennis court in the backyard.
Yeah, he did.
Now he's an educator. After he finished his soccer career, he became a teacher?
During his soccer career too. Because, okay. You know, domestically in Australia, you know, there's not that type of money. It's not the pro sport. My old man's 70 now. So
yeah,
Australian pro sport back in the day looked a little bit different to what I'm a big NFL fan. And you know, they're not on those types of contracts. But so was mum. Mum was a school teacher also. Four sisters, no brothers. So a lot of the time it was up to me to kind of make my own entertainment.
But were you identified as talent by Tennis Australia? Were you practicing with Kyrgios and Kokkinakis and Demonauer and all these guys? I know you're a little bit older, but not that much. How did you come up?
Yeah, in the state, a little bit maybe, but I was doing some state squads, but not really, I would say. We had a centralized program back then. It was called the AIS, the Australian Institute of Sport, based down in Canberra. And there were a few guys in my age group that were selected, but I was never really selected. I think they thought that, you know, I worked hard, but I wasn't good enough. That probably gave me a bit of a chip on the shoulder and a bit of a screw you mentality.
Hang on a second. So the coaches at Tennis Australia didn't think you were good enough and you worked harder.
I imagine, I mean, that's how I saw it. I mean, I think that's how anyone would see it.
Of course.
If, you know, you weren't in that premier product, right?
And who's your age grade? Who is better than you then?
Yeah, I mean, I was right up there, but we had guys like Bryden Klein, Greg Jones, JP Smith, who's still playing a bit of doubles. These guys, our age group didn't necessarily kick on and do, you know, a whole lot. We weren't a bad age group. We just didn't quite have that success that came a little bit later.
Well, you got to 33 in the world. That's good, man. Come on. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, but it was a slog. And the reality was, to begin with, I wasn't good enough. You know, I didn't really know what to expect when I finished school. So when I was 18, I just said to mum and dad, I want to give this tennis thing a crack. But I did it pretty tough. I flew over to Europe by myself and I would spend up to 11 months a year overseas. It was expensive. Like I said, in Australia, I don't feel as if we have quite enough tournaments. And so you have to spend these long, drawn out times overseas. For me, it was Europe, only because not necessarily, I didn't know what clay court was when I went over there, really. But there were a lot of tournaments. As you know, if you're not getting into a tournament in Italy, you can get on a train and be in France in 2 hours and you can play a tournament there. And so that was my journey, but I wasn't good enough. I had to really work at it.
So you went and grinded.
Yeah, I grinded most of the time by myself. And the tough thing then was financing it all, right? Because I didn't want my parents to go and mortgage a house. And that's where I think kind of like funding early on in your career, 18, 19, 20 kind of can really help. So I was playing club tennis. I played club tennis in Germany. I played club tennis in Switzerland.
Bundesliga.
Yeah, it wasn't the top league though. You know, this was third, fourth division.
Really?
No, not to begin with. And also I was kind of trying to find these deals myself. You know, I've never had a manager in my life or an agent in my life. So, you know, I'd be getting on the computer back then because you didn't have the smartphones when I first started traveling. So I'd be getting on the computer and I'd be sending the emails and trying to build contacts to try to source some deals to play and fund, you know, the rest of my dream. It was terrible for your ranking because, as you know, during those European summer months when you were playing club tennis, you couldn't go and increase your ranking.
Tennis is so tough.
It is. It is really tough.
Tennis is so tough. Think about what you're saying right now.
Yeah.
You got to 33 in the world. You were playing third tier club tennis.
Oh, maybe 50.
To put a few thousand bucks in your pocket, have a free place to stay, just to keep yourself alive.
Yeah, but what it does is it keeps the dream alive and it toughens you up a little bit. And back then, you know, I don't see it how I see it today. How I see it today is like, well, like, what were you doing? Like, literally, when I was playing tournaments, if I wasn't winning, it was, you know, I'm going to spend these next couple of nights on the floor at the airport down the road, you know, like, I mean, that's just how it was, but it was an adventure. And that's how it is for a lot of players. You know, that's not just me. That's how it is for a lot of players. It's just, luckily, I did get the results and I managed to keep on improving. And then, to be fair, on Tennis Australia, they, you know, they identified you and said, you know, like, he's putting in a bit of work here and he's getting some results. And by this stage, you know, I was kind of around, you know, playing Grand Slam qualies and that. And it started to look as if maybe I could make something of my tennis, or at least make a living out of tennis. Because as you know, to make a living out of tennis, you probably have to be top 100, especially back then. It was, you're not making much of a living, and the risk and reward isn't quite worth it if you're lamenting deep outside top 100.
I mean, and you had a shoulder surgery right when you turned pro. And then you did.
I had three surgeries, that second shoulder surgery you're about to say was real crossroads at my career for me. It was, that was a real tough moment for me. I think I was about 130 in the world at the time, and really the year before I'd played all this club tennis, so I had nothing to defend coming up. We were heading into around that French Open time, and Tennis Australia with their trade deal had given me the wild card into Roland Garros. And so I'm thinking, you know, 130, nothing to defend for some months. That top 100 dream that I had in my head, that I'd put so much emphasis on, was really becoming a reality and becoming something that I was really believing. But my shoulder felt bad all of a sudden. I remember playing in Munich and I felt something pop. I'd gotten through qualies there at the tournament that's on right now.
The BMW.
Yeah, it's a great tournament. I love it there. I got through qualies and my shoulder kind of went bad. So I kind of grinded the next few weeks and I got to Roland Garros. And just before the qualies draw was made. So as you know, when the qualies draw gets made, if you are a main draw spot, which I was with the wild card, then it would go to a lucky loser if you pulled out, and Tennis Australia would lose their wild card. I got another scan, and the first scan didn't show it, but the second scan did. I had quite a significant labral tear in my right shoulder. So then they said, you can get some cortisone. It might take away the pain. You might be able to get through your match. But you know, you probably are going to need surgery. I got the cortisone, but did I feel comfortable walking on the court if I wasn't fit and taking away an opportunity for another Australian? I didn't feel comfortable. So that was a really hard decision. I turned down, especially after grinding and not having any money. I would have had a nice payday and be able to, you know, live out a dream, play main draw, Roland Garros. I didn't play any of the junior stuff. So that was a real special moment for me. But I actually turned down the whole car. I called Nick Kyrgios, got it, and he ended up having a pretty good career. So, look, it was a tough time. I went back home. I had the surgery. Tools were down for a fairly long time because I couldn't play tennis, and I wasn't even sure if I was going to come back and play. there was a bit of a crossroads moment there where probably semi-depressed, and I thought, you know what, I want to just throw everything at it because I felt like I had a little bit more to give if I could get that shoulder right. So it took about 13 months between the shoulder surgery to when I was playing at a half-decent level again and where the shoulder actually felt like I could get through a tournament. As you know, during that stage, I had a moment there where there were, at the end of the year, there were three tournaments actually in the States. Napa Valley, beautiful place. Really, it's disappointing that I don't have the Challenger there because homestay at Napa Valley was incredible. There's some great properties there.
Yeah.
Sacramento and then Tiburon. And I left with 6,000 Australian dollars. So that's about 4,000 US in my account. And that had to cover my flights and all of that. I was getting homestay, so I didn't have to pay for accommodation. But that was really kind of the be all end all. That was chips all in. I either get some results here or I have zero money and I'll go back and study. And I went quarters, semis, finals. In the semis and finals of Sacramento Tiburon, I lost to Sam Querrey. And that kind of really set me up. After that, it took about 9 months and I was top 100. I went from no rank to just about top 100.
All right, so listen, you got to tell me, what's it like to play Roger? What's it like to get the W in a major? I mean, on paper, it's the number one thing you ever did.
Yeah.
What's that? What was it like?
Oh, look, it was a bit of relief, actually, which sounds a bit funny, but I'd been in a position to knock off one of these good players before. In fact, I was up a set and a break against Roger at the Brisbane International, one of my home tournaments. And the hardest thing is actually to kind of get through the finish line, to run through the finish line. As you saw a couple of years later, I couldn't finish him off. And that's what these tough guys are so hard to put away. So when I think he hit maybe a forehand out, I would say, from memory. And when that ball kind of goes over the baseline, it's more like, oh, you can breathe. It's a bit of relief. But I got to tell you, walking onto the court, you're a little nervous.
He never missed.
No, and look, he not just that, when you're going onto the court, and I always used to try to tell myself not to play their reputation, but you are, you know, there's extra baggage when you're playing against these guys, especially someone like Roger, who's done so much for the game and how much of a key figure he is. You know, in my opinion, for what he's kind of done for the game in terms of his stature, I have him as one of the biggest names in sport in general in my generation. You know, I have, you know, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, and I have kind of Roger Federer there.
No doubt.
Whether that's silly or not, when you play against these guys, that's what you're also playing against. And so to get one over him on the biggest court that we have in the world, you know, Arthur Ashe Stadium, it's not a small court, was really special. And a fun little note, in your locker the next day is a really nice touch from the USTA. You have a little framed photograph congratulating you on your first win on Arthur Ashe, which was really cool. And I think it's at my parents' place somewhere, so I'll go try to hunt that down now that I've got my place here in Brisbane.
What are you most proud of?
You know, the career highlights for me actually isn't the Roger one. It's the two Olympic Games I went to. I loved it. We're in an Olympic year, and it's probably the one thing that, you know, if my body had of last, and that's why I stopped playing tennis, my body just couldn't quite last. It had nothing left. I would have loved to have played one more Olympic Games. Olympic Games at Roland Garros. I mean, I think that would have been just so special. And the other thing I'm most proud of is, again, representing the country at Davis Cup. So fortunate to be able to play underneath Leighton Hewitt, someone that I grew up just loving. I remember my first hit with Leighton. I was playing US Open, and he got me out on that P1 through 6. It's just outside where the cafeteria is. And they're normally a bit quicker. And geez, they were playing quick that year. And I remember I was nervous. I'm hitting with Leighton Hewitt, who I, you know, just loved. And he's putting in those little dart balls that underspin almost. And I'm just catching them late. But, you know, fast forward a few years later, and he's giving me a start in Davis Cup. And just something that I'm incredibly proud of, to be able to represent something that's just bigger than myself. Tennis is an individual sport, but there's a lot of moving parts behind the scenes that get you onto that court. You know, family support, your team support. And I felt as if when I was representing my country, whether it be in an Olympics, but especially at a Davis Cup, I was truly representing those moving parts that got me to that stage. And for me, that is the most special thing.
And you Aussies are into it over there. What do you have the tattoo? Like Demon Hour's got that tattoo. Do you have that? The tattoo with the number?
So I got my Olympic rings here, and I was just saying to Fee, I'm about to book in and get my number. I'm not going to get it on the chest.
No.
Demon Eyes looks a bit like a prison stamp. I don't know where he got his done. I think in the basement of some person's place in Alicante, but I'm going to get mine here.
And what number are you?
I'm 108, so even more significance, you know, and that's a really nice tradition for people who are listening in who might not know it in Australia. And it's a tradition in a lot of different sports in Australia. It's not just the tennis. You know, the cricketers in Australia, they all have their number on their shirt and on their baggy green, which is their hat that they wear.
For our listeners, that's the number you were selected in the history of the sport for Australia. So, yeah, you're 108. You're the 108th Davis Cup player.
Yeah, for Australia. And when you think about how long Davis Cup's been going on, and if you, I'm a bit of a history buff, and so you think about some of the players that have gone before me, it's pretty special, you know, cool. Rocket, Muscles. So yeah, 108, even more significant there, and this is the kind of nerd in me talking, that Tony Roju, in my opinion, that generation of player that Tony Roach grew up in, you know, and this is nothing on those other players, but Tony Roach has done more for tennis than just about anyone else in Australia. That guy is incredible. He's number 54. So to be double Tony's number, 54 to 108, was really special. And Roach's just, I can't speak more highly of that guy. There was a time there, especially when I was kind of coming through. And look, I got to 33 in the world. I didn't get to the heights that some of our other players have gotten to. But, you know, I'm proud of that. But there was a time there where there wasn't a whole lot around me. You know, we've got a kind of a bit of a wave coming through right now, and it comes in cycles. And there were times I felt as if when some of our former players were a little bit critical of, you know, the center tennis, and, you know, back in their day, they were dominating. But Roachie was never one of those people. You know, he was always one of those people that were like, okay, if there's a problem, I want to try to fix it. And so he was always someone that you could talk to. He was always someone that would get out on the court. I think that there should be stadiums named after Tony Roach. I think that he's that significant in Australian tennis.
No doubt. You don't have to even say Australian tennis, say tennis.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy that took Lendl to the promised land. He's been with Roger. He's probably coached more players that he's never spoken about, that no one even knows about, than anybody in the history of the sport. There's stories about Tony Roach that nobody knows, that this guy's done incredible things.
It is actually crazy, and we won't go into it any further, but it is crazy if you go through the players that he's coached.
Yeah, no, it's
and people wouldn't even know that, really.
Right.
But yeah, what a person. I hope that there's a stadium with his name on it soon.
What's it like to be losing and knowing that you're not getting it done? Think something's changed.
Yeah, really, really challenging. It feels like, you know, when you're in the ocean and you can't see the bottom.
Yeah.
And you're kind of a bit going, you know, you're a little bit apprehensive, and there's a bit of anxiety that creeps in, and, you know, you're a little bit edgy. That was kind of me towards the end. The thing that I was struggling to wrap my head around is I still felt as if when the body felt good, I could compete and I could play at a high level. But, you know, I had to play 11 months a year. Towards Federer's end of his career, he was playing, you know, two tournaments, and then you wouldn't see him for 5 weeks. And then I didn't have that luxury. I had to play to keep my ranking where it is. I had to be doing the grind, because I wasn't going to get results every week. That just, you know, there's a lot of good players that were of a similar level of me that competed. physicality and it was something that was really important to my game. I had to go out there and I had to run and pound the pavement and make an extra ball, and I had to be able to fight. And when you lose confidence in that, then you get that real uneasy feeling each time you walk on the court. How's the body going to be today? You know, is the shoulder going to hold up? Is the back, am I going to be getting those severe spasms that I was getting throughout the back end of my career? It was a real challenge, and that's when I knew, you know, if I can't fix this, then I'm going to have to start thinking about, you know, the transition and the game, the end game plan.
I imagine you talked to your wife and just said, "I'm not playing anymore. I'm gonna shut it
Yep.
down." And you did that over the holidays, and then you shut it down in January at the Australian Open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 2023 was a challenging year. I actually had a really good Australian summer and was hitting the ball really well and felt like I was playing some good tennis. But then I left for a trip to play some of the indoors at the start of the year over in Europe. And it was stop start over there. I was really battling. Probably the cold weather didn't help, but I was being held together by injections, by cortisone injections. I was being held together by I was taking that many painkillers. And then I had to get home. And so we went, you know, surgery wasn't really an option. I didn't really want to go down the surgery route. That's 12 months. And at my age, I'm probably not coming back from that. So I went down the option of hitting the gym hard and doing a lot of the rehab and taking a time away from actually hitting tennis balls to try to get back in. And I went back and played in the US very briefly. But by that stage, I probably knew. You know, we're talking August, September. I probably knew then that, you know, there's not a future in this. Whether I can push on another 6 months or a year, I'm on a downward trajectory. So that's when I decided that the Australian summer would be my last one. So I really wanted to tick every box possible, as much as I could do. My preseason looked a lot different to what it did in the past. So, you know, really set high standards in the past of putting in a big body of work, but now it was kind of just fine-tuning it. And I actually really enjoyed being back home and seeing kind of in Brisbane, we have a few good young ones training there, and I liked getting on court with them and you know, hopefully helping them in their little journey, because it's an exciting one when you're at the start of that journey. It's exciting. There's a lot of unknowns, but yeah, if I can pass on a little bit of that.
Jim Courier introduced us in Australia. You were working a lot. You were working in the Good Morning America show, and you were writing an article, and you were very vigorous, which is sort of de rigueur for articulate ex-players. Will you do more? Are you going to be vigorous on the tennis circuit, the hit and giggle circuit, the broadcasting, the charity, the pro-ams, the all those kind of things?
You know, it is all about opportunity. Those opportunities are more available when I'm at home at the Home Slam in Australia. I enjoy it. I enjoyed working with Jim. Holy moly. I think he's the best in the business.
So it was you and Jim on Australia Channel 9.
Yes. Yep. Nine's Wide World of Sports and Leighton's there and Todd Woodbridge. And to be able to just talk tennis with those guys is pretty incredible. So still learning my craft there, definitely. But look, that was a lot of fun. The challenging thing, and as you know, tennis is a global sport. You're only at home, at least in Australia, you're only at home for a very small period, the month of January, and then you're away. And for me, kind of rebuilding those relationships back home and being able to spend time back home has been the priority. And so I'm not necessarily chasing those international gigs right now at all because I've done enough travel for now and I'm enjoying being home and doing different things. And like I said, tapping into those relationships you have to put on hold for the last 16 years. So, yeah, look, maybe in the future, but right now the study's fine. I'm enjoying something a little bit different, but I think tennis is always in your DNA. So at some point in time, in whatever capacity, I'll return to that. for sure.
Let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10-ball scramble. I say it, and you say what comes in your mind. You ready? We go fast.
Okay.
We don't drill down on anything too heavy. Ready?
Okay.
Your favorite tournament?
Wimbledon.
Your favorite court?
That would be Pat Rafter Arena at Brisbane.
Your favorite non-major tournament?
Oh, that's a really good question. Look, I have to say the Brisbane International.
You love the Brisbane International.
Yeah, it's home. I'm a massive homeboy.
Not Astana. You won Astana. Come on, man.
I love that tournament too. And I'll tell you what, the hotel there was incredible. Ritz-Carlton, beautiful tournament. No, Astana's fantastic. We've got a lot of really good tournaments. Borstad was always a lot of fun.
Borstad.
Beautiful place. Stockholm, yeah. I mean, playing in Sweden, you're pretty lucky. I mean, we've got so many good tournaments, guys.
Your favorite racket?
Oh, the Technifiber T5 320, which they don't make anymore, but mine were painted, actually.
What size grip?
4 3/8. No, 4.5. 4.5, sorry. Towards the end of my career, I went thicker. Sorry about that.
Leather grip with an overgrip over it or no?
No leather grip. No, I didn't like the feeling of the leather grips. Yeah, I wasn't old school.
A cushion grip.
Yes, cushion grip. They're just the cushion under grip. Yeah.
And then how'd you string your racket?
Tight. Like, proper tight. Towards the end of the career, it was about 68 pounds.
68 pounds?
Yeah, it went up. It went up, yeah, 65 to 68, depending on the place where you were at.
What kind of string?
I used a poly, so it was the black code, Technifiber black code. Their equivalent of like a banger almost, but a little bit softer than your bangers.
That is so tight.
It was, yeah, and then that's why my shoulder was kaput and my wrist and elbow.
I was going to say, do you think that would be fair to say that your racket setup did some damage? That's like a lifetime achievement award.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end of the career, for sure. Like, I wasn't getting quite as much out of it. More so on the overhead stuff. I still felt as if down here I was getting, there was still a fair bit of life. But up above, you felt that tension, like, in a big way.
The most fun you ever had on tour?
Any time in the Davis Cup camps.
Yeah.
They were also the most stressful times. But to be around those boys, we had so many laughs. It was awesome. Loved it.
Your favorite player growing up?
As a Queenslander, it was Paddy Rafter. Like, every single Queenslander just worshipped Pat Rafter. I played nothing like him. Yeah. I would have liked to have been able to volley like him. But no, he was a hero. Every now and again in the summer, he'd pop up at like where a junior tournament was and he'd just do a training session there. I remember one in particular at Coops, and it was like heaven for a kid. Yeah, legend.
Favorite player now?
I mean, one of my best mates is Alex Diminar. He's awesome.
Yeah.
But I love storytelling, and I love going through the stories. And you know, Jannik Sinner, I know this is fast fire, so apologies, but it's actually not a bad little story. Was I remember I would have been about 35, 40 in the world. I was playing in Monte Carlo, and that was always the first clay court tournament for an Australian.
Of course.
Because you'd come home after Indian Wells, Miami, and then you'd go over there. So Monte Carlo's the first one. So I always would get there a few days early because you jet lagged as anything, and put my name down, plus looking at the desk in the change rooms, which is a little bit unique to a tournament. You don't normally go to practice desk in the change rooms. But and then the next morning I rock up and 9 o'clock, whatever, someone signed up with me, which is always a good thing. Because normally an Australian tennis player, they're not signing up for the clay court ones. So it was a guy called Jannik Sinner, and I didn't know who Sinner was. So I asked, one or two of the guys, and they go, oh, he's this young Italian guy, 17, 18 years old. I think he'd just done really well. He maybe won a challenger the week before, and yeah, he's got some game. Yeah, it'll be a good hit. So we go up to the top, those back courts of Monte Carlo, and man, you could tell from the first hit that this kid was good.
Man, the ball sounds like a cannon off his racket when he was 17, 18.
Yeah, and that's it. It's the sound of the ball, it's the sound. It's just pure. We end up playing a practice set, and I reckon it was about five all when we got kicked off the court. And to be honest with you, I wasn't disappointed. I was like, I'll take five all and I'm out of here because this kid's a young kid. And I was at, like, I was playing good tennis back then, and you could just tell he was going to be special, right? I remember fast forward just at this Australian Open, I remember him doing some ball fed with Darren Cahill and Simona Vignozzi. In the indoors, and I was just having a bit of a listen, and I mean, it sounds like a cannon.
Cannon.
I've said for the last couple of years that at hip height he's the best ball striker in the world, and it kind of came into fruition at the Australian Open. So I love watching those types of players, right? Like, yeah, he'd be one of my favorite players because I kind of was there at the start. Well, not at the very start, but his professional journey.
Yeah.
It gives me great pleasure to see them kind of grow up, and I hit with him a fair bit, and he's just an awesome player. So definitely those types of players are my favorite for sure.
The most cavalier thing you ever did with prize money, right out of the office.
Well, I'm a bit of a conservative person with the money. I gotta say. Straight away, as soon as I qualified for Wimbledon, I knew I was getting paid. And it was my first time I'd ever qualified for Wimbledon. And it was after that shoulder surgery. And as soon as I walked off the court, the first thing I did was fly mum and dad. They were on the next flight over to Wimbledon. And I would rather spend my money on other people than myself. And mum and dad are the ones that deserve that. So yeah, I would say that.
Approved. The line judges.
I understand the theater of having line judges, but I much prefer the automatic calling now.
Rafa.
Absolute greatest competitor, I think, that the game's ever seen.
Medical timeouts, MTOs.
I don't like them. I prefer us not to have it in general. I think if you once you walk on the court, that should be it. If you're not fit to play, then you should be pulling out.
TUEs, therapeutic use exemptions. Do we have a problem in pro tennis?
I really don't like them at all. I think that they're all right if they're used with the right intentions, but I think anything like that can just open up, the floodgates. I'd prefer not to have them at all.
Is there an Adderall problem on tour? Are guys popping them and getting an advantage?
Look, what I will say is you hear rumors of it. I'm not saying that you go into the change rooms and you're seeing people, popping Adderall, but you hear rumors that there are TUEs with people, taking advantage of something like an Adderall. Correct.
The most interesting thing you can tell me about that victory over Roger.
I left the courts at about 2 in the morning, and I was up 3 hours later to do my fantasy football draft. they asked me how I felt on the on-court interview after just beating Roger, and I said, "Oh, I'm actually really wondering who I'm going to take at first pick 3 hours later in the fantasy football draft."
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you were the king of tennis, you could make any change in the sport with no aggravation, just a swing of the racket. What would it be?
Look, simple measures is to speed up the game. So a really simple rule change. If you throw the ball toss up, I think that that's part of your serve. I hate catching the ball. Like, I think that that should be part of the motion. So that would be the simplest one. But on a more of a holistic level, if I could wave my magic wand, it would be that more people make money from tennis. I think it's just disproportionately high with the top end making the money. We play a global game. I think there's incredible athletes outside of that top 100, and I think that more people should be making money from this sport.
Now it's Thursday morning. Do you have school?
No, I'm in there tomorrow though. So today I'm gonna do a little bit of my assignment because there's one that's due on Sunday, and yeah, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 8 in the morning and 5 o'clock each day, and we're in class all day. So yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Will you watch any tennis, or have you just shut it off since the you were still watching some tennis?
Yeah, no, I watch the games that interest me. I don't watch every game, but yeah, definitely when the Aussies are playing, I'm trying to watch them. And then, those select few that you're fans of.
The popcorn.
I'm a fan of Yannick. I'm a fan of Carlos. Yeah, I love those popcorn matches. And it looks like Steph's actually starting to play some good tennis again, which I think is actually really important for tennis.
I always tell everyone, I say, man, if you haven't seen Stefano Tsitsipas play on clay, it is just a work of art. It is something very fun to see.
Yeah, no, he's awesome. He's awesome to watch. I love the all-court game that he kind of brings in. I love variety, and I think he brings in a little bit of variety to the game, and I think that's really important. And that's why I also think that court surfaces, and this could be one last little thing I will say, because this could be another change that I would make. I would love to see a little more variety in court speeds and surfaces again. All those hard courts are playing so slow and are chopped up and are rough as anything. I'd love to see every now and again you go and you go to a really quick place again, where it's like playing on glass. I think that there needs to be a little more variety because it can become a little bit boring.
Hey man, this is a pleasure. John Millman, you are released.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Huge thank you to John Millman and thank you to Diadora. Use my code approved in all caps at hollibirdsports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. Scopesports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. See them at scopesports.io. Megan Fernandez edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.